believe it is.
Yeah. Another one? Yes. No, obviously not.
How does that work?
Well, a person could, they were given the choice of a 1 to 5 Likert scale. They could choose, if they choose 4 or 5 for any response, Lisa categorized them as interested in working in that sector. So a person might be equally interested and might therefore circle both options, or might have circled 4 on 1 and 5 on the other. That's how that might have happened. Miriam?
First one, these two investigated persons, they income of a nurse from, the income of a nurse, the middle income, the average income from nurses. Second.
Wait, so did you understand that question? The income of the nurses. Did we investigate the income of the nurses?
This is the first question. The second question is double or even triple employment are common in many, many developing or underdeveloped countries.
Right. So did we look at whether nurses had more than one job? Okay. Okay.
In some countries of sub-Saharan region, and also in the Caribbean, I have no information. And this would be one of the reasons of looking for migration.
Right. So looking at the issues of how many jobs they had and what their income was. Are you asking Amy this or Lisa's paper? Right.
Or no, she recommends, if not, she recommends this or advice for further studies.
It was not part of the research study that I undertook. Neither question was part of the research study. And if nurses, it would be up to the nurse to mention it when I was on the phone with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I have multiple jobs and I'm, but it was not.
I would recommend this.
Okay. I think the purpose of Amy's paper was a strictly a location exercise. So, all right. Gerard?
In the Uganda project, is there a reason why there are more students from other countries?
It's a bigger nursing school, considerably. The McCrary Nursing School is a fairly smaller enterprise, and it's kind of buried in their medical school. Okay, we're going to move on now. I am going to talk a little bit about U.S. policy towards physician migration, and then Emily is going to talk about some policy options that we face. So I didn't introduce myself. I'm Amy Hagopian. I teach at the University of Washington School of Public Health. I got my PhD there. My interest has been in the area of health workforce for a long time. I started my career doing rural work in the U.S. and worked for the University of Washington's WAMI program, Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. We are the only medical school for that 5-state region, and so for almost 20 years I traveled the region working with small rural hospitals and clinics to help them strengthen their services. Okay, I have no financial conflicts to disclose. I thought we should just start with the concept about physician density and how we measure it, and typically that's done with physicians per 100,000 ratio. You can see just from this slide capturing a few countries that there's a huge disparity in physician-to-population ratios. Mozambique, it's as low as 2. The United States says 280 in this slide, and I think that number is even higher now. The four wealthiest countries in the world, who are often the target of migration studies, have about one-fourth of their physician stock imported from other countries, with large components from low-income countries. You can see from this slide that the U.S. has imported 1 in 4 of our doctors, and about 60% of them are from low or lower middle-income countries, as categorized by the World Bank. I know this is a little bit hard to see, but we did this study of foreign-trained physicians using the AMA master file to learn which were the big sending schools around the world, just by school of training, not by country. And it turns out the University of Santo Tomas in the Philippines has produced more physicians in U.S. practice than most of America's 175 medical schools. There's also a growing number of private schools abroad that are catering to this population of young people who would like to become physicians in order to have a vehicle to migrate. We're worried a little bit about the quality of those medical schools, and I think that is an issue worth monitoring into the future. The consequences of this migration are significant. This was a story in a London newspaper reporting that Philippine hospitals are closing because of nurse migration. I had a student a couple years ago who did a survey of nurse leaders in hospitals and how they viewed a migration from the Philippines, and that paper is actually out now in International Nursing Review if you want to look for that. So meanwhile, graduation of new doctors and nurses in these rich countries has not kept pace with the demand for health care, even in the top 30 OECD countries. And in fact, graduation rates have declined dramatically in many countries, such as France, due to caps on the numbers of medical school places. This has only been reversed very recently, and the reversal has just started to influence graduation rates, as you know. The medical pipeline is quite long. Takes a long time to reverse policy on production of health workers. We will have about 1 million doctors in the United States within the next 10 years, but that is going to fall short of the demand by 85,000 doctors and short of need by almost 100,000. Obviously, demand and need are two different things. Demand is a fiscal capacity to pay. We aren't going to get into that issue, but clearly those factors matter here. The structural mechanism by which we attract foreign doctors to the U.S. Is through our residency training programs. We have built in capacity for 34% more residents than we graduate from our own medical schools. And that proportion is expected to grow. The Council on Graduate Medical Education, COGME, originally had a recommendation 15 years ago that residency training positions should comprise only 10% more than we have medical school graduates. The anticipated shortage of physicians in the U.S. is now leading us to policy positions that will lure even more foreign-trained physicians to this country. I'm going to talk more in a little bit about how we use residents when they come to the United States for training. After 25 years of very small growth in U.S. training capacity for physicians, that first COGME report came out in the early 1980s, coinciding with the beginning of the Reagan administration, at which time we froze any expansion of medical school training seats or numbers of schools. And now we are finally working towards an expansion since that time. We have no will, apparently, in this country to solve our maldistribution problem. So the excess number of physicians going, and we're also not solving the issue of the excess number of physicians going into specialty medicine, and we're also not solving our broken finance system, at least not so far. So all these factors conspire at the same time to create more and more demand for foreign physicians. However, with this new report predicting a shortage, the American Association of Medical Colleges is considering now accrediting the Caribbean medical schools that are training a large number of American kids who can't get into U.S. medical schools, and it is signing on to efforts to persuade schools and the legislatures that fund those schools to expand training capacity. When we make policy in this country about how many medical students we want, these are state-by-state, school-by-school decisions. There is no national policy on how many medical students we should have. What should our pipeline capacity be for training physicians? We have no plan in this country for any of these issues. So we will continue to import physicians from abroad. About 6,700 new foreign graduates entered our residency training programs in 2007, continuing to stoke the large proportion of fully licensed physicians who are from abroad. This map illustrates where IMGs in general are most likely to gather when they arrive in this country, and as you can see, it's the big cities of New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, Houston. When physicians come to this country, they are typically in training for residency positions. They have to get repeat a residency in this country, even if they did one at home. And we use those residents to staff our big city hospitals and emergency rooms, and they provide a lot of care for poor people in this country. So, meanwhile, I think it's important to keep an eye on the specialty mix of U.S. physicians. Only 38% are now considered generalists, and new U.S. graduates are shunning generalist careers. When that happens, foreign graduates fill the residency slots available in those less popular residency programs, and this doesn't bode well for a healthy medical care system in this country. I'm going to leave the policy response to this to Emily, who will speak next, so I'm not going to get into that. But I did want to touch on why this matters particularly. When we create a giant sucking sound here for medical graduates from low-income countries, there are consequences at home. This graphic comes from the Joint Learning Initiative report, which came out in 2005. And in that report, they attempted to describe the number of health workers that a country needs in order to achieve basic coverage of services. The two lines here illustrate measles immunization and attended births. And it appears that when a country achieves 2.5 health workers per 1,000 population, it can achieve pretty good coverage on those two factors. I know the blue line that's supposed to be there is hard to see, but it's sort of right there where those two coverage regression lines start to level off, that we achieve 2.5 health workers per 1,000. That same JLI report was provided the first reasonably comprehensive look at worldwide health workforce distribution, and it set some benchmarks, which we talked about, the 2.5. They attempted to categorize countries by the density of health workers and their childhood mortality rates. If a country had fewer than 2.5 doctors and nurses per 1,000 population, it was considered low density. If it had high childhood mortality, it was high mortality. And of the 45 countries in the low density, high mortality cluster, 37 are in sub-Saharan Africa, and two notable others are Afghanistan and Haiti. I'm going to talk about the stakeholders in the various policy options that the U.S. has chosen to pursue. Medical schools in the U.S. clearly have a serious stake in this discussion. Enrollment rose significantly in the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, but as I explained, it leveled out after that initial COGMI report. This is just to show you how our own medical school expansion has happened in the last couple of years. We now are graduating 216 students a year from the University of Washington, and you can see that is a relatively reasonable expansion, 21% increase. There's also been a new osteopathic medical school open in the eastern part of our state. They admitted their first class of 75 students this year. There's more and more osteopathic training going on in the U.S. In order to compensate for what is perceived to be a shortage here. So I talked a little bit about U.S. residency training programs. The enrollment in those has been flat for some time, although the AAMC has now recommended a significant increase. As I said, we already have 34% to 44%. There's different estimates on this. More slots in residency programs than we have medical school graduates. These slots, by the way, are paid for by largely Medicare. So Medicare is where we are making our policy decisions about how many foreign-trained physicians to have in the United States. It's a sort of very odd place to find that policy to be made. It's not explicit. I'm not sure Congress understands it's making that policy when it chooses to fund Medicare at the level it does. In 1997, the Balanced Budget Act put a cap on the number of residents Medicare will fund. Medicare pays about $70,000 per residency slot. Since immigrant physicians, as I said, have to first complete a U.S. residency program, clearly the programs in this country that are attempting to serve underserved people have a major interest in making sure that we continue to have a reasonable supply of physicians for those programs. That puts these programs in a very odd spot. All these inner city emergency rooms and inpatient facilities, as well as community health centers, are put in the position of having to advocate for continuing our policy of importing physicians, because this is the core of people we use to deliver this care. IMGs are not distributed evenly across the states, so there are some states with bigger interests than others in our policy on immigration. These are the top 10 states, and these are the top 10 who import African physicians in particular, and those are the countries. You can see Nigeria is the biggest contributor to most of those states. There was a meeting last spring in Kampala, Uganda, which was the first International Global Health Workforce Alliance meeting sponsored by WHO, and they adopted a declaration that called for a number of policy initiatives. They suggested that countries that are sending away too many health workers should improve working conditions. They should massively scale up their training capacity. They should improve human resources for health management and information systems. Lenders to poor countries were specifically admonished to lift spending limits on health and education as conditions of their loans. And rich countries were urged to train enough of their own health workers so that they're not luring those from abroad. Some folks coming out of that conference are also working on an international code of practice on migration. There's a draft of that that circulated for comments. It was interesting to note the U.S. response to the Kampala Declaration. You can see here, it was a very odd moment at the end of that conference where this woman from the U.S. delegation rose and read this statement, which later appeared on their website. And she said, while the U.S. government has not signed on to the Kampala Declaration or its agenda, we look forward to continuing to work on this critical issue. I think that was unfortunate. It is fair to say that American Public Health Association has taken some stands on these important issues. Those of us in the International Health Section drafted some policy positions, which APHA has adopted. I think these are important. And those of you interested in working on this issue should get involved in the International Health Section and continue to move forward some of these policy positions. We encouraged healthcare employers in the U.S. to adopt a code of conduct on recruitment, and we encouraged the lifting of spending restrictions on low-income countries through structural adjustment programs. The New York Times, interestingly, came out with a recommendation that the U.S. compensate countries that are sending us health workers from abroad. This editorial came out after the AIDS conference, what year was that, 2004? And it was in direct response to a Physicians for Human Rights report on medical migration authored by Eric Friedman, who's a colleague of Gerar, who's in the room here. There was, however, a recent comment by the current U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, Christy Kenny, who was asked about the brain drain and the idea of compensation for health workers taken from low-income countries. So the Washington Post quoted her as saying that she'd never heard of it, the brain drain. She'd never heard of it. She's the delegate to the Philippines, and she's never heard of it, and that she doubted the U.S. could afford such compensation. That was September 24th, 2008. I always like to just remind ourselves that there is an international human right to migrate. Physicians have, and nurses have, the right to migrate just as much as anyone else. No one is obligated to live in a country that they don't want to stay in. This is a picture from our own immigrant rights march in Seattle in May of 2006. Nothing in my remarks is intended to restrict that right to migrate. We are only talking about the consequences of policy. So thank you very much. Okay, so somebody took my introduction sheet. Did you do that, Amy? No. Okay. So Emily wrote me this really nice little statement about herself, so who took it? Okay. Emily Duriel, wherever she is my coworker at Health Alliance International. She is a graduate of the University of Washington School of Public Health, where she got her Master in Public Health degree. What year was that? Just this year? That's incredible. Anyway, we were smart enough to hire her full-time as soon as she graduated. And if I find that thing and I realize I failed to say something, I'll say it at the end. Thank you. These reports, by the way, from Physicians for Human Rights, I think are on the back table if anyone's interested. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I realize there are many, many other places you could be, but I want to say if you like health worker migration, you're going to love codes of conduct on health worker migration. Very exciting.
Okay, how do we get out of here?
Escape.
Really?
Go to delivery mode, maybe.
Delivery mode, that's a good idea. Let's go there.
There you go.
Next present.